Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So we all know that watching your weight can be a very difficult process. You've got to manage portion size, calorie intake, even the types of calories you consume. And of course, you have to make sure you get enough exercise. Well, now it turns out you also have to monitor your relationship status as well.
That's right. A new study out of Ohio State University tells us that getting married or divorced can lead to significant changes in weight, and not always in the way you'd expect. Karen Weintraub writes for WBUR's Common Health blog, and she's written about this study. Karen, thanks for coming in.
No problem.
So the study says that marriage and divorce can act as weight shocks. Are they just talking about people putting on a few pounds when they get married? That's kind of standard, right?
Right. Most of it is just the difference in lifestyle. So you're suddenly living with someone and eating all your meals with them, or not if you get divorced. And that can be a change in your lifestyle that you don't have on a normal basis.
So was the impact of marriage on weight different for men and women?
So with men, particularly for divorce, it was a bad thing. Men tended to gain a lot of weight in divorce. That may explain why men's health tends to deteriorate after a divorce. We know that men do worse when their marriage ends than women do, and this may partially explain that.
That's such an interesting finding, because it's quite intuitive to figure you get married, you put on a few pounds because you're not working for it anymore.
Right.
But, like, you know, that goes against the social trope, which is that men get divorced, then they hit the gym, and they buy the ridiculous car, and they go to hair club.
Right. Well, the researchers are now looking 4 years out. They only look 2 years out. So it's possible that the first 2 years, the men wallow in their misery, put on a little weight, and then they wake up and start going to the gym. They're going to look at that next.
The study also looked at people's ages at the time that they married or divorced. What impact did that age have?
So when we're older, we think our lives are more stable. We're not changing very much. But they found that when women in particular, when they married later, that it was a dramatic change to their lifestyle, more so than in an early marriage, and they tended to put on more weight.
And why do you think that is?
Maybe they're out of the dating league. maybe they're feeling like they need to make meals or sit down with meals with someone that they haven't done before. Or maybe their husband just eats in a different pattern than they've had.
There was another interesting finding of the study where they looked at single people, right?
Yep. So single people tend to be heavier over the course of their lifetime than married people. Again, putting the lie to your theory that people who are on the market will work out more.
Yeah.
Maybe they're depressed. Maybe they just don't feel like they need to look good for anybody.
Or maybe that's why they're single.
Yeah, I don't like to think that, but okay. Yeah, maybe.
Karen, you got another interesting post up on Common Health this week about weight loss and bariatric surgery specifically. Tell us about this.
Right. I was kind of surprised. I sort of assumed that because we're all getting fatter, that bariatric surgery was keeping pace with that increase. But in fact, it isn't. It's stabilized, flattened out since about 2004. We haven't had a lot more bariatric surgery. And that ranges from the lap band, which is a band put around the stomach to make it smaller, to gastric bypass, where they actually bypass part of the small intestine, attach the stomach to the middle of the small intestine.
That seems very strange because, as you said, the obesity epidemic
is unabated.
It's unabated, right? So there's been no accompanying increase in the number of people looking for this, for some people, quite miraculous surgery.
Right. And I also expected that it would come down because the safety rate has gotten much, much safer. When we first heard about bariatric surgery 10, 15 years ago, you heard about stats as shocking as 1 in 100 dying. It was a really pretty scary procedure. And now they've gotten it down to 6 in 10,000, which is pretty low and probably in most cases safer than being as obese as you have to be to justify the surgery.
So the researchers who are looking at the rates of bariatric surgery, do they have a policy takeaway for people? Are they saying that more people should consider having bariatric surgery?
You have to take this a little bit with a grain of salt because I only talk to bariatric surgeons, so obviously they have some interest. But yes, they are strong believers in surgery because it really does have the best results. It's very hard to lose 100 pounds, 150 pounds on your own. Much easier, much faster, more reliable to do it with surgery.
Well, it's a couple of very interesting posts, and people can read them right now at commonhealth.wbur.org. Karen Weintraub, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's time now to hear some of your feedback from our past shows. Yesterday, we did a story about student loan debt and the rising rates of default among students, especially minority students. New York Times writer Claudia Dreyfus believes the cost of education is a key factor.
Why are we indebting such large numbers of young people at age 18 with huge, huge loans because the price of higher education has skyrocketed?
Listener Kathy wrote in to agree that there is something wrong with the basic idea of students having to go into debt to get an education.
She writes, "We need more non-loan financial aid and lower college costs. The current discussion seems to be about how only the rich should be going to college and everyone else should be a plumber."
But a listener who commented as DH001G says, "I went to private school for undergrad and ended up with loan debt. True, I wish I would have had better career counseling and more counseling about student loan debt, but really, it was worth it."
We also received a lot of response regarding a story that you did last Friday, Adam, about Michelle Kojelek.
Yeah, listeners will remember that Michelle Kojelek was born a male but is currently suing the Department of Corrections to get them to pay for a sex change operation. She's serving a life sentence for murder in MCI Norfolk, where she lives as a woman. New York Law School professor Arthur Leonard told us that recent rulings in other courts around the country suggest the legal tide may have turned in Kojelek's favor.
They said, "We've seen evidence in this case that prison systems spend a lot of money on health care for a lot of different conditions, and that in fact gender reassignment surgery is not out of the ballpark for other things that they pay for."
Now, many of our listeners were outraged. A listener writing as guest says, "Prisoners have a right to food and shelter. If they are sick, they have a right to be treated. But never should tax dollars go to anything like this."
And Dan Smith 123 writes, "Changing your gender is not medically necessary for this person. Why any time at all is being wasted on this ridiculous lawsuit is beyond reason."
Now, we did another story last week about a new pilot program the TSA is launching at Logan Airport. The TSA will now be interviewing passengers, every single one of them, that are traveling through Logan's Terminal A. They're going to start with simple questions like, where are you headed or how long will you be there?
And they'll watch for subtle cues, changes in the movement of the eyes or maybe some perspiration on a cool day. That might indicate the person is not being totally truthful.
A lot of listeners didn't like the idea of this sort of behavioral screening. A Radio Boston listener identified as DDuckW wrote, "The worst thing the TSA can do is rely on interviews by poorly trained individuals and then assume that the screening is working effectively."
And W. Singer wrote, "The TSA's apparent mission is to make people feel they are being protected while actually doing almost nothing to protect the flying public from terrorists."
But listener DGH Mail Can had a different take, writing, "Any attempt to improve on the current pornographic manhandling of women and children by the TSA should be applauded."
Listeners, we'd love to get your opinion. Go to our website, radioboston.org. Learn all the ways to contact us.
Well, up next, Ethan Allen and the sketchy real estate deal that gave us the great state of Vermont. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.